Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle, and I am joined on the program by co-host on the left, Shireen Gorbani. Hi, Shireen.
Hello, and hey to the listeners. Thanks for tuning in.
And on the right, co-host Dan McKay. Hi, Dan.
Hi, everybody.
Senator Dan McKay. Hey, Senator, quick question for you. We got to talk about Donald Trump. We haven't talked about him for a long time, but...
Who's that?
The Trump Organization's been charged with criminal tax fraud, and the CFO is charged. This is Alan Weisselberg. Avoiding taxes on $1.7 million in perks that he didn't report as income. Is this just the start of a lot more, Dan?
Well, listen, you're talking about $1.2 million in a multi-million dollar organization. And to be honest, I guess I'm not that surprised that, you know, that their accounting may not be as buttoned up as it should be, one. Or two, it probably might be the kind of thing that will, you know, Weisselberg will probably have some kind of settlement, they'll pay a fine, and they'll move on. Like, and that's one option. And then another option is that it's like the launch into a whole bunch of other things. And this is classic. If you've never worked in a district attorney's office, I have. I can just tell you this is a classic thing, right? You put the squeeze on somebody you think has more information, right? So this is, if they think this is the tip of the iceberg, how did they get the tip of the iceberg to crack? And they did this to Trump during the campaign years. The FBI was charging people on his campaign. And now they're doing it to, you know, as private entities and private organizations. And that kind of stuff is just, I guess, the thing that's the tool. I personally think there is no chance that any of this gets to Donald Trump. That's just me.
Shireen, the sort of saying where there's smoke, there's fire comes to mind to me.
Ah, tell me more about that, Natalie. What do you think?
Well,
that's just because you guys are hanging out in the smoker's lounge. Stop hanging out in the smoker's lounge. You'll be okay.
I just, if former President Trump ran his business like he ran the presidency, I imagine there's a lot of fire there.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. There's a these continue to be stories that I feel like are just providing evidence for the obvious in many ways. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next. Certainly, I don't think this is a surprise to anyone, especially given his tax returns, just knowing the way that he does business, the fact that this is not the, you know, high quality business organization. He's not some genius businessman. Many people understood this, but kind of how this all comes together, I do think is going to be problematic for the Trump brand. And I'm curious to see where it goes.
Mm. Shireen, let's stick with you and go to the Olympics and talk about the track star. Is it Sha'Carri Richardson, who tested positive for marijuana? Looks like she won't be competing in the Olympics this summer. Cannabis is on the World Anti-Doping Agency's list of prohibited substances, but it's legal in many states. There's not medical evidence that it's a performance-enhancing drug. Curious what you think about it. And I'll just say it certainly does help with stress, which I think could be performance enhancing. But your thoughts?
Yeah. So if you did not see her win the race that qualified her for the Olympics, I would recommend going to watch it. It was an incredible run. And one of my favorite things to do is to watch people who are truly excellent at what they do, you know, do that thing. So I recommend that. This is a larger problem, really, outside of the Olympics, which has a lot of issues going on right now. But the United States really does need to deal with the classification of marijuana as we're seeing legalization in state after state. How this is navigated and what really is considered a prohibited substance or what is not is something that does deserve deeper investigation and a real understanding.
Mm. Dan, I don't know what you're thinking, but she knew the rules, but she also had a family crisis, and I don't know. I know this isn't a left or right issue, but it's interesting to hear your thoughts.
I would just say that she should not be kicked out of the Olympics for marijuana. I think it's personally stupid. What we know about marijuana scientifically now, especially for adults and some of those other things, this is dumb. Now, that said, you got to have rules. And so there's a rule and she knew them, and she chose to, I guess, take marijuana. So that being said, look, I'm looking forward to the Olympics. I really am hopeful that we are going to see a great games, and that you know, we'll do the one thing which can do us, which I think can do the world a great bit of good, which is coming together and watching our athletes compete and do their best. I love the Olympics.
Yeah.
I got to ask, Natalie, are you excited for the women's soccer team?
Oh, yes. Yes, I sure am. And I found myself, I've been up in the Tetons and I was hiking below the Grand and came across another fellow soccer fan. And we ended up talking about the women's national team for a couple of miles. A complete stranger, but it was fun. Hey, Dan and Shereen, there's this interesting story, and I don't know the name of the lobbyist, but it's an ExxonMobil lobbyist who Greenpeace tricked into thinking that he was talking to a corporate headhunter, and instead he was talking to Greenpeace. And in the process, I guess his name is Keith McCoy, he spoke candidly about his work and shared a lot of things about Exxon that weren't too becoming, right? You know, basically said that they're, you know, acting like they support a carbon tax as a public relations ploy because they know the tax will never happen. He identified the 11 U.S. senators that are seen as crucial to Exxon's lobbying efforts. And basically he got tricked, Dan. These are always interesting stories when people have the mic on when they're not thinking about it.
Well, you know, I think I would be in a lot of trouble if my golf buddies decided to, you know, record our conversations on the golf course, just because, you know, when you think you're in this safe space and so you're telling your friends, you know, one thing or another about, you know, what you really think about things. There is no question that many people, myself included, really try and guard what we say so that it isn't taken out of misperception, so it doesn't show badly on the state, it doesn't show badly on our organizations, it doesn't show badly on our constituents, and or it doesn't show badly on me. And clearly, you know, Mr. McCoy seems like he this is going to show badly for his organization, show badly for his industry. And it goes back to, you remember the age-old recordings from the Krispy Kreme in Provo. You know, you have to assume that these conversations in a lot of situations are being recorded. And so, I think this is going to be hard for ExxonMobil to spin other than you'll see a termination and you'll see a further investment into, you know, the issue.
Yeah. Shereen, your take on this one.
I would just say, you know, ExxonMobil being disingenuous about their support for a carbon tax or real implementation of the level of commitment that we need to address the climate crisis that we're watching before our very eyes. I didn't expect them to be an honest partner, and I'm not sure many people on the left ever did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. I think I echo the sentiments that you shared. I also want to ask you, too, about Attorney General Merrick Garland, who's now halted federal executions until the Justice Department conducts a review of its policies and procedures on capital punishment. I thought this was a fairly serious action that's not gotten a lot of press, Shereen.
I agree. So what I hope this is the beginning of movement towards the ending of federal executions. There is a good reason to do this. These systems are deeply racist. We know that there are huge racial disparities in the way that the death penalty is applied in states and also at the federal level. And I just don't believe that we should be in this business, especially given the questions that there are around the drugs and the methods that are used. So I hope that this is the first step in that direction, and it's something that I would be proud to see happen.
Interesting. Dan, I was in an off-air conversation with you where I guess you've toured the new prison and seen some of our facilities out there. If I remember right, you went in the room where executions would happen in our state.
Yeah, and I hope we never use it for that reason, right? I mean, I'm hoping maybe we can turn that room into a healing and a counseling room or, you know, something else. But the federal crimes and doing away with the federal crimes and the death penalty for the federal crimes is one thing. The reason why I don't think it's getting much play, honestly, because I think most Americans are ready just to see this practice go away, one. And two, I think it's there's so few people. I mean, so narrow for a federal crime to lead to a death penalty. Mostly what you have state crimes that are death penalty and death penalty capable. And so the large majority is states. You have not had the federal government execute a person in decades.
That's
and
not
so,
true.
I'm glad you said that. Who was the last one?
The Trump administration moved forward with a number of federal executions at the end of that presidency because they knew this decision was coming.
Okay. So I would just say that's, I think, one place where I really differ from some in my party who really think that the death penalty is a great tool. I think it's horrible. So I'd be, you know, let's get away with it at the state level and let's get rid of it at the federal level.
We're all agreeing here. I've always had the saying that, you know, the state or government doesn't give life and it shouldn't take life. So interesting. Hey, we've just got just a few minutes left, but I wanted to hear what each of you thought about the Boy Scout settlement on sexual abuse. I guess it's the largest settlement of a child sex abuse case in U.S. history. More than 84,000 people have joined the lawsuit against the Boy Scouts. It was an $850 million settlement, Dan.
Well, this is a big number, right? And the fact that the Boy Scouts of America are in agreement, you know, that's a big deal. It's by the way, it's 350 million more than their original proposal, as I remember. And so you've seen, I don't know how the Boy Scouts survive something like this. 850 million is a big number. They're talking about going to each individual state and having the states be liable for a large portion of that number from their perspective. Like, I think it's to the tune of 550 million is going to be distributed to the states and their individual chapters to make up that difference. And I don't know how they get that money other than sale of real estate and those kinds of things, which will really weaken the program.
Shireen, you get the last word on this.
So I'll just say, as a person who's done advocacy work in the area of sexual violence, that this kind of news, especially about the Boy Scouts, the stuff we were seeing last week about Bill Cosby, can be incredibly triggering for individuals, especially those with PTSD. If you find yourself in these conversations or if you yourself are in need, there are community resources like the Rape Recovery Center has a 24/7 crisis line that you can call to get connected to support. But also as a friend or as a family member who may hear information like this, it's just so important to, you know, validate people's feelings, hear them out, and do what you can to connect them to supportive resources. This is the action. I guess the settlement is coming from deeply harmful and deeply painful experiences that have happened all across this country.
I'm Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gorbani and Dan McKay. In our next segment, we're going to talk about how Utah will spend $205 million to help students catch up after COVID-19. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gorbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and we're going to talk for just a minute here about Dan and Shireen, you know how during COVID we saw so many students, particularly in kindergarten, first and second grade, who basically fell behind. The state had a study that there was a 14% drop in the number of first graders who had the expected level of early literacy skills. And so here we've got some federal money, and it looks like the state is going to commit about $205 million to help our students catch up after the tough impact of COVID-19. Shireen, love to hear your commentary on this.
So I'm really grateful that we're seeing this level of investment to really make sure that we can get students to where they need to be. This is certainly an issue of education. It's also an issue of equity. When we look at the pockets where kids were falling behind, and this was happening nationally, so not unique to Utah, but our children of color, kids from BIPOC communities, were those who were falling behind the fastest. And there are lots of different, you know, interventions that are currently underway. So summer programming that's being offered, some of these dollars will go in to bolster that. But really the effort to make sure that we're investing in our kids, trying not to lose this last year, is something that I'm proud that we're doing as a state.
Yeah. Dan, I don't know, are your kids or have your kids ever been in a Title I school?
My kids have not. So we've, you know, out in the suburbs, it's hard to find a Title I school, you know, outside of really West Jordan is kind of where they cut off. But my kids haven't been in a Title I school, but we've certainly visited a number of them as we've worked with refugee families and those kinds of things. So we're very aware of some of the issues that have gone on, especially during COVID-19 and the difficulty of connecting kids to the internet and getting technology into their hands and you know, the immature, I would say immature, just because we didn't have the infrastructure in place to really support, you know, our educators in the ability to deliver an online education experience. So there are a lot of kids who fell behind. There's no question. And it did disparately affect those of our underprivileged in Title IX schools.
Yeah. I'm not sure why I felt inclined to bring it up, but I you know, we know that these impacts have not been the same. We also know that they do play out in every district and across genders and across grade levels and across subjects, you know. But I brought up the Title I because that's where there's the highest concentration of poverty than anywhere else. And I guess I was personalizing it. My kids, I'm a Murray resident, and my kids have always been in a Title I school. And it's an incredible experience to be a part of and see the interaction. And I'm just really thrilled to see the state targeting this money. So that's my take from the political middle. Let me also ask you, and maybe Dan, maybe you're the right one to set this up. I don't know. Did you see our Governor Cox on Face the Nation this week?
No, I didn't. Darn it.
Well, he's getting a lot of attention, right? Because he basically said that politics is becoming religion in our country. And that it's becoming sport and entertainment in our country, and that it's a huge mistake. And, you know, I don't think you can really quarrel with him, can you, Dan, on those points?
I can easily see a separation between religion and politics. I guess, I don't know, it depends on what you mean. I think politics and religion have always been two taboo subjects at the dinner table for the most part. So trying to say that one is becoming the other, I don't know. That feels a little overgeneralizing. But I think the point he is trying to make is that the fights and the division that's coming from it is not necessarily healthy.
Mm-hmm. I find it interesting because our governor is demonstrating a willingness to speak. I don't know, Shireen, is it truth to power or is it just truth to circumstances?
Well, I'll let you be the judge of that. But I do think, so I did listen to the interview, and it was in the context of, you know, where we're at in terms of our vaccination rates and really understanding that we have a lagging number when it comes to Republicans in this country, especially Republican men who, I think it's 38% who say they will not take the vaccine. And when we think about what's happening with the Delta variant on the rise and just the more, I guess, contagious nature of that happening, this could have really devastating consequences in small pockets. And I'm hearing our governor's frustration as we are seeing deaths continue in the state, even though that number is low. Many of these individuals simply did not have to die. And I have to say, I appreciate the ways in which he has been very direct about that message. And I do think that there is some truth, whether that's truth to power or to, you know, speaking just what's happening in the moment, to the way in which we don't always have incredibly thoughtful reasons that we follow a particular party or set of ideologies.
Dan, I'll go back to you. Did you see the Washington Post poll that found that a majority of Democrats, it was as high as 86%, have received the campaign compared to 45% of Republicans? And I don't know, how do you explain that, right? I mean, it's science. How do you explain that?
Well, it's science. Sure. What I can tell you is there's just a reluctance, I think, in general for people to, I think the dynamics of the vaccine will change once the FDA says, I think I've said this before, once it's no longer an emergency approval, that it's an actual approval. We have so much testing going on around it. You know what I mean? So this vaccine in all of its iterations have been tested more than most of the current flu vaccines and most of the other, you know, vaccines that we're currently doing for chickenpox and some of the others. That said, people are just suspicious of generally vaccines and that kind of stuff. And I get the talking point, and I actually think it falls flat, in my opinion, when people say, well, you know, these people don't need to die or it's some of these things. I genuinely think most people that do not take the vaccine are doing it on purpose and they're okay with the consequence, right?
Yeah.
And good or bad, like that's where they're at.
Mm-hmm. So after a lot of negative mailings from Club for Growth and, you know, some other commentary, we now have Ali Isom, the latest Republican, to challenge our senior Senator Mike Lee in the 2022 election. Ali has filed her papers. Ali's a personal friend of mine. I'm a big Ali fan. But I'm going to read a quote, Shireen, and then just ask you to comment on it. She said, "Our nation is at a crossroads. I think the Republican Party is at a crossroads as well. The public dialogue has denigrated to a place of rancor and division and us versus them mentality that I think is actually really dangerous in the long term for public policy solutions."
Well, that sounds like truth to me. I would certainly agree with that statement. I find that our Senator Lee is often a part of what I think are some of these rancorous and divisive moments that we are experiencing, you know, recently in our political arena. I think we would be well served by somebody who is interested in public policy solutions that are reflective of the issues that we're facing in this state.
Dan, let's hear your commentary on that quote. But as I say it, I also want to ask a secondary question, which is just what will it take to have one of Utah's fine women serve as a U.S. senator? What will it take?
So let me deal with the quote and that kind of the conversation, because the rest of the quote just talks about, there's another part of the quote that was right after this. It said, "We are weary and wounded from division in our families and our neighborhoods," and that kind of thing. Right. And can I just tell you, like, I think Ali is a very good communicator. From a campaign fan and somebody who like follows campaign tactics and that kind of stuff, I will actually tell you that this op-ed is very damaging for her as a candidate. And what it does is it shows a weakness, not leadership. Mm-hmm. And sadly, even Mitt Romney, who talked about, you know, we're going to say nice things only in D.C., is actually found that even the nice things you say are divisive, they're coming out of D.C. And, you know, I'm tired of politicians telling me we're at a crossroads. Like, I'm tired of it. And maybe it's just, they're trying to use that as a toehold to boost themselves up and give them a platform. Okay, that's fine. We're always at a crossroads, right? Like, that's the Cheshire Cat, right? We make a decision every day about everything that we're doing on a regular basis. We're at a crossroads every few seconds that we're trying to make a decision. So I'm tired of politicians trying to, you know, add themselves that they're the answer to one of these crossroads, when at the end of the day, whether or not we are more rancor or whether or not we are worse off or better off or that the country's getting worse, I don't buy any of it. I just don't. I think that the country generally is in a mode where we're constantly cyclical in how we deal with things. But I remember the stuff that people said about George W. Bush, and they've forgotten it all now, and he's this great president. I think that you hear the things that people said about Bill Clinton, and he was absolutely horrible. And now you hear Republicans saying, well, he's one of the better presidents we've had of recent years. So I'll just say we are divisive about politics. We could be nicer to each other. I'm grateful that when I go into the gas station and I'm standing behind a Democrat at the gas station, neither one of us cares what party either one of us is from. We're able to talk about the weather. We're talking about the little league game around the street, and we're going to have a great time just, you know, chatting up at the deal. And we're not going to bring up politics because honestly, it's just divisive the way it is.
So I have to just ask, because many of the sentiments that are expressed in this Isom piece are exactly how are now Governor Cox ran his campaign. So I'm curious if you thought when it was a man doing it, that it was a political liability.
No, I think.
Oh, so it's just for women.
No. It's not that it's different. I just think it's the same. What I'd say, though, is that I didn't like the way the governor that was his campaign mode either. What I did like about the governor is that he said, and he did this, and he stayed true to it. He was very on message as to the great things about the state of Utah. And he didn't ever use words like, we are wounded, we are weak. I don't like that type of deal. But Natalie asked another important question. We just blew it as a chance for a state, right? We had a woman as one of the top three to be considered as, you know, for the state treasurer. And instead, we went ahead and, you know, found another guy to fill a statewide race, which, okay, I guess that's what we do. But it's extremely disappointing when you look at the outcomes. I do feel like women are unjustly treated in the state of Utah, for, in politics Same. Especially.
Same.
Wow. Well, and we have too little time left in the program to really dive into that. So I'm going to tell our listeners, we'll jump into that next week. Let's do it, shall we, Shireen and Dan?
I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, because, you know, I would just say from the political middle that sometimes, Dan, the things that you hear that don't speak to you do speak to me. And I don't know if it's, you know, gender. I don't know if it's backgrounds. I don't know if it's mainstream conservative versus, you know, farther right conservative. But I've listened to what Ali's saying, and I find it very refreshing. Last two comments, and then we're going to have to end the program.
I just hope everyone had a safe and firework-less 4th of July.
And Dan, to you.
Hey, I'm just glad nothing is on fire here on the Wasatch Front, and that's a big deal, really, for this fireworks season. It's great. Let's keep it up, peeps.
You got to love it. I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. I've been with Dan McKay and Shireen Gourbani. Our program is produced by the amazing Anthony Scoma. Hey, thanks, everybody, for listening.